Thank you. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everyone. This is the IRTPB call, 31st of August. And on the call, we have James Bladel, Paul Diaz, Barbara Steele, Oliver Hope, Timonetta Batiga, Michele Nilon, Mikey O'Connor, Barry Cobb, Kevin Erdman, Chris Chaplow, Matt Serlin, and Anil George. And we are trying to call out to Bodwan Shombi, who should be on the call any minute. And for staff, we have Marika Koenig and myself, Glenda Sanjuri. Thank you very much. Michele, over to you.
Okay, good afternoon, everybody. Sorry I missed last week, but I believe that James did looked after you wonderfully, as always. Or at least that's what he told me. Somebody mentioned there in the chat about SOI updates, or DOI, which sounds to me like something involving alcohol. So I'm not too sure what the best format for handling this is, but I suppose the simple question is, if anybody has any changes to their disclosure of interests, could they please let them be known? Marika might be able to clarify this. Go ahead, Marika.
Yeah, this is Marika. Disclosure of interest is actually a different thing from a statement of interest that's normally provided at the start of a working group. As I understand, the disclosure of interest is more related to the agenda for a specific meeting, and whereby members are requested to disclose whether they have any specific interests on the topics of the agenda. We are working on some instructions or some further clarification on, you know, what that means and how that can best be handled at a different, you know, the start of a meeting. And I know that some elements are still under discussion by the, you know, the relevant work team. So, you know, more information is forthcoming, but I think at this stage it's the intention is that members state at the start of the meeting if they have a specific interest in one of the issues that is on the agenda for that specific meeting.
Okay, thanks. I've already been very vocal in my criticism of how some people are trying to handle this in some other working groups. I'm already on the record on that. It can become a bit unwieldy. Just to cover my own declaration of interest, I'm a registrar. So therefore, if there are problems involving transfers, this causes me a massive headache, which costs me money and time and headaches, and that's pretty obvious. If anybody has any strange disclosures that they'd like to share with us that we haven't already worked out, please go ahead. But I think most of you, it's pretty clear why. But anyway, I await further instructions on this. I also believe from the call last week that it was decided not to delve too deeply into the ETRP stuff at the moment. Is that correct, James?
Yes, this is James speaking. Acting on the suggestion of Paul, and I think the group consensus was that we would defer that and discuss comments on other topics first, because there were fewer of them and they seemed slightly less controversial.
Okay, perfect. Okay. Are there any other issues that anybody wants to raise? Oh, Marika has her hand up again.
This is Marika. I just have a question. Are you already moving to agenda item 3, or do we first pause at agenda item 2? Because I would like to say something.
Yeah, okay. Let's do things in order so that I don't confuse people too much. Feedback from ICANN compliance. Marika, go ahead.
Yeah, this is Marika. I sent out a response to an earlier conversation that was started on charter question E in relation to denial reason 7 and also some comments that relate to denial reason 6. And some other further comments have been made on that. And I actually just wanted to propose, because I think I think we're all heading in the same direction, but I think conversation through email, you know, makes it difficult and as well slow, because I'm checking internally as well with different departments and then getting their input. But, you know, I think we're thinking along similar lines, and I think the email that James sent on, you know, focusing on the issues of, you know, not having locks that are not visible and ways for registrants actually to remove any locks that are there. I think basically it boils down as well to the main points that that are there from our perspective. But what I would like to suggest is maybe to see if I can get Pam Little from Compliance and Dan Halloran from our legal staff to join one of our future meetings, possibly in 2 weeks' time, so we can actually have a, not face-to-face, but a conversation around these issues, which might make it easier to maybe come to some kind of agreement on where we're heading and how that could be best addressed.
Okay. I would personally would agree with that. Does anybody else have any comments or thoughts on that? Paul?
Thanks, Michele. It's Paul. And to Marika's point, the exchange in email sometimes can be somewhat disjointed. We may be focused on one particular thing or missing the broader exchange. Therefore, very, very much appreciate the opportunity to have Pam and Dan on the call so we can talk it through. For anybody who's not had a chance to see the emails, though, I just want to put back into the record the point that I was making yesterday in that the suggestion, at least as I read it in the prior feedback from staff, the suggestion that we change the rules in the IRTP and make affirmative consent to have a name locked a mandatory requirement, I think is a very, very bad idea for security reasons. I refer everybody to the list, and hopefully that was, again, one of these taking things somewhat out of context. That was not the intention of staff, but I think it should be pretty clear to people that's the classic unintended consequence. By making that sort of requirement, it seems almost assured we're going to have large numbers of folks who will not affirmatively respond, therefore their names will not be locked, and will be that much more vulnerable to a potential hijacking or takeover situation. And therefore was not in any way in favor of that proposal. But again, let's have the broader discussion with legal, with compliance on the phone, make sure that we're all on the same page, because I think everybody's interest is doing the best thing for registrants. But, how we get there and what we propose is we have to be very, very careful.
Marika?
Yeah, this is Rick, and just to comment on what Paul says, I think indeed you're absolutely right. I think the underlying thought was that indeed there's a need to make locks visible and not have invisible locks, and do the best for the registrant to make sure as well that if that those kind of locks, they need to be visible and there need to be obvious ways for a registrant to unlock them in a timely manner. So I absolutely agree. I think I think we're heading in the same direction, but probably benefit from some further discussion to see how we can, work that in the IRTP, and as well hear from compliance how, what they need to actually enforce those kind of provisions.
Okay. Anybody else? Any thoughts on that? Okay. Marika, could you just let us know how you get on with organizing a time slot with them?
Rick, I actually already had an exchange with Pam, and, although she's based in Sydney and this time of day for her is basically midnight, she's willing to join our call on the 14th. I believe it's next week is the... So in 2 weeks' time, so I just need to check with Dan Halloran if he's available as well. For him, it will be 7 a.m., so we're written in complicated time zones, but hopefully we can actually stick to our regular meeting time.
From my personal perspective, and I don't know what other people think, but if we could have at least one of them on a call and from time to time, it would be helpful. From my own views, it was when David Geezer used to join the calls, it made things a lot simpler because we were able to ask him, what do you think of X, and what is your experience with Y, and it removed a lot of this kind of sitting around waiting for people to go off and come back and stuff.
Yeah, this is Marika. You know, I agree, but I think you know at this point in time it might be a bit complicated seeing the staffing of the compliance office and as well that Pam is located in Sydney, where you know our meeting time doesn't really map to her her hours there. But you know she's indicated that you know on a one-off basis she's willing to participate and you know for the time being on other issues. You know, I think it might help if I'm go in between, although that might be a bit slower, but hopefully we'll. Able to have more more regular communications in the near future.
Okay, thanks. Any other points on this? Okay, we'll move on. I think is there an echo on my line, or is it on somebody else's line?
I don't hear an echo.
Okay, I daren't ring back in, but it'll probably take 15 minutes. Okay, how far have we got with the public comments?
This is Marika. We covered the first three comments, and you'll see in the Adobe Connect the notes from our previous meeting, and would just like to encourage everyone to review those and let me know if you know I missed something or misstated anything. So if we would skip the comments on the ERTP for now, it means that we would go to charter question B, which is comment 29, would be the first one on page 6.
Okay, perfect. Okay, then, so so would you like to walk us through some of these, Marika?
Yeah, I'm happy to read them out. The comment 29 is from the Internet Commerce Association, and they basically say that there's from their side no support for changing the current practice and adopting a rule that only a registrant and not its administrative contact can initiate a domain name transfer that does not modify contact information.
Okay, so does anybody have any thoughts or comments on that? Okay. Go ahead, continue, please.
It would be helpful because what we're trying to do in the document actually is to you know, incorporate the working group's view on the comments. So should I just put then no view, or does the group agree?
James and Bob both have their hands up, so there might be some sub-views. James,
great.
Go ahead, and then Bob.
I'll defer to Bob. Go ahead.
Okay, Bob, go ahead.
Thanks, James. Maybe you could explain it. Maybe I'm a little thick. I'm not quite sure I understand the point. You're saying that only a registrant and not the administrative contact can initiate a domain name transfer. Where does this does not modify contact information fall in there? Are they saying that if only the registrant can initiate a transfer that also includes the modification of a contact info? Maybe someone could clarify that for me. I'm just a little confused.
Does anybody want to answer that, or shall I? Bob, do you remember that we've discussed this before, the difference between the registrant and the admin contact?
Yeah, I understand that perfectly. What I don't understand is how the modified contact comes into play. How does that?
Oh, right. Sorry. Go ahead. I can't speak to that. James, go ahead.
I don't have an answer for Bob, and I'm kind of asking the same question.
Our friend from the Internet Commerce Association on the call today. I don't think he is he?
Michael is on the call, but I'm no longer with the Internet Commerce Association.
No, I know. It's, what's his name? Phil Corwin.
Phil Corwin.
Is Phil Corwin in this group? He is, isn't he?
He is not.
I don't think so.
Don't think so.
Okay, sorry. It's about the only working group I'm on that he isn't in. Sorry. Is there more to the comment than the bit that text, Marika?
This is Marika. The comment itself starts off with in relation to the UDRP question, basically starts off saying we have no objection to consideration of whether domain should be locked when it's subject to a UDRP proceeding, so long as the matter is considered in the context of a balanced and comprehensive PDP and a UDRP reform. And then it says, I'm going too quickly here. Actually, relating to the question on thick, who is where this this comment is named, and I'm just wondering, I was trying to pull up the issues report because I'm trying to think if somewhere in the issues report we actually spoke about this possibility of having different rules for a change that doesn't involve a change of registrant. I know we spoke about it, but I don't recall exactly what we said in the issues report. So I'm wondering if it is in relation to discussion around that issue. So basically, the comment is made under a heading that's called "Thick Who Is for All GTLDs." It starts off saying the ICA has no objection to the initiation of a PDP to consider whether all GTLDs should be required to maintain a thick who is so as to better facilitate the secure transfer of all registrant contact information. Until such a PDP is initiated and reaches its conclusion, we do not support changing current practice and adopting a rule that only a registrant and not its administrative contact can initiate a domain name transfer that does not modify contact information. However, we would not object to ICANN providing additional advisory guidance to registrars on this issue.
Okay. Is that a bit clearer for you, Bob? And I see James has his hand up.
Go ahead, James. Sorry.
Yeah, this is James speaking. And I guess trying to get my mind around where we're going with Are we discussing the substance of each comment and trying to arrive at some sort of a working group position now, or are we just reading through them, or what are we doing today, first of all, because I don't want to dive too deeply into this if we're just going over the comments.
Well, we're kind of making we're looking at the comments, trying to understand what they're saying, and then seeing if we agree, disagree, or feel any way about towards their comment. I mean,
okay.
My
opinion is the thing that's missing in this particular comment is a why or an alternative idea, because as we've discussed, through the lengthy discussions of ETRP and TDRP, as well as is mentioned in the SSAC, having one user that has all or nothing control over domain name is part of the security and hijacking headache that a lot of folks are dealing with. So I guess rather than be a wholesale rejection of any changes to that idea, I guess I would like to understand why. Just because we've now collected at least three or four different data points that show that this is a problem and something that should be at least open-minded to looking at. Thanks.
Okay. Mikey?
Thanks. This is Mikey. I think that one way we could dispose of this one is something along the lines of acknowledging that the last part of that comment is confusing and that we don't really understand the objective there, and then move on.
Okay.
It's almost as though that was a throwaway sentence that has been sort of vacuumed up a little bit out of context, and I suppose one option would be to go back to Phil and ask him to clarify it. But, the sense I get, since it was in the context of the thick who is point that he was making, is that maybe his fingers just ran away with him on that one.
Okay. Marika?
Yeah, this is Marika. I just pasted in the Adobe chat the relevant section of relating to issue B where we talk about this, and in my view, his comment is directly in response to this paragraph in which we actually specifically ask input from the community on this proposed recommendation, where we talk about, you know, possibly making a change, you know, when it comes to a change of control or not. So, you know, maybe people can take a second just to review that. It might be easier to put his comment into context.
Okay. Any takers? Anybody? No?
Hang on, I'm reading.
Okay. Simonetta.
Well, from a secondary market's perspective, I could see how if you require that the registrant is the only person who is authorized to start a transfer, practically speaking, in terms of how communication flows with who gets what type of email, I think that a lot of registrars wouldn't necessarily always require that just the registrant can respond to the acceptance of a transfer request and things like that. So I could see how if you change the rule from it can either be the admin contact or the registrant to it must be the registrant only, how that would hinder trading names. So in that context, I would agree with the comment of Phil Corwin that this is not, this wouldn't be nice for the secondary market, and it would make it harder to trade names.
James?
Yeah, I would just follow up with that, and I think that we had some earlier conversations when we were discussing some of the challenges where of disputes between admin and registrant when they were two separate entities and one was selling the name and the other was not. And I think that in some respects this might clarify the secondary market into which party has the ultimate authority to sell a name and which party buyers should be dealing with. So I think that you know, right now there's some ambiguity in there, and I would think that perhaps that was a way of clearing that up.
Michael Collins, Simonetta, and then Mikey.
Yes, I wanted to agree with James. I think the reason that we discussed this, and I probably had some input, was for that reason, was that having only one authoritative party could help to resolve disputes before they occurred, help to avoid disputes over domain name transfers. And however, I think we decided that because there isn't a thick registry for .com in particular and some other TLDs, that it wasn't something that we could suggest as a change, but that we would consider that a move to thick registries might be a solution for this as well as some other problems.
Okay. Simonetta?
James, I would agree with you that if that were practically working, that this would be nice because it would actually clarify roles. But I think from where we are currently with registrars in effect having different operational procedures in place, it would not be a practical solution at this point in time.
Mikey?
Yeah, it's Mikey. I found that recommendation that we made in the middle of the text that Marika pasted into the chat. We recommended that only the registrant can affect a change of control while both the registrant and the admin contact remain eligible to authorize a transfer that does not modify contact information. That's where that came from. And so that's the context that Phil is making this point. We certainly debated this enough in the prior realm. I suppose we could open the debate up again. I tend to agree with James that the issue is the two parties having control over the same name problem and them basically going in different directions. And I'm not sure that we tied this entirely to Thich Nhat Hanh. I guess I'm not terribly swayed by the argument that, oh, it's operationally hard, so we shouldn't do it. I think it's perfectly okay for us to say this is the right thing to do and put out a reasonable implementation expectation so people aren't unduly burdened by it. But I tend to stick with our recommendation. I think we beat it up pretty hard and came to a good recommendation there.
Okay. Bob, and then Simonetta again.
Yeah, this is Bob. Sorry, Mikey, I was not part of that that debate that you referred to. I guess the only thing I would ask is, does this pass the test that there is enough of a problem to merit? Because it sounds like it sounds to me, Mikey, like the change, the recommendation you're referring to is a change from what's currently done. And I guess the only question I would ask, at the risk of inviting some rehash, is did it pass the test that there was enough of a problem? Was that problem quantified? And with that, did the working group agree that it would justify affecting the change in the way it's currently done?
Simonetta and then James?
That was exactly my comment as well. And it just practically speaking, again, I've been working in roles where I had to have access to systems like our online banking system or other pieces that corporations need to have access to. And in some way, domain names are a little bit like that. So with personnel changing over, sometimes it's really tough to have this one login. And if two people are actually able to do something like agree to a transfer, for a lot of entities that might be really nice to have, and it's currently possible. And I'm just wondering, are we making all of this a lot more complicated over an issue that might not be that big?
Okay. James?
Yeah, and I don't know that we're prepared to release any specific data. I can tell you that this is an issue such that we have a team to resolve these types of disputes internally. And it certainly attracted the attention of the SAC to the point where they issued an advisory report. But really, I don't think that, and maybe the problem is both the confusion on this call and with the ICA's comment, is that perhaps this working group jumped to too quick of a conclusion by saying, that only the registrant should be able to authorize transfers. Perhaps what we're really saying is, we need to understand the difference between the role of the registrant and the administrative contact in general. And I think that much of our earlier discussions would be, we're pointing out that not only would this enhance domain name security, but it would clean up the inventory in a lot of the secondary market activities where there is a question of whether or not the two parties that can authorize the sale of a domain name are in agreement. And we use the analogy of the old ICBM Air Force missile launch keys, where two people had keys and they had to turn at the same time. And I think that that is an interesting security feature, and we would just need to discuss whether that's even appropriate. And I think what we're really trying to say in this particular sentence here, or this recommendation, is do we need to clarify what those different roles are? It says very clearly that the registrant, can overrule the administrative contact, but it doesn't really say how that is. So I think maybe we just need to spend some more time on this.
Okay, thank you. Any other comments or thoughts at this juncture?
This is Barbara. I have my hand up.
Oh, sorry, Barbara. I didn't see that.
That's
apologies.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, one of the things that the registry constituency mentioned in our statement, and I think it's a couple down from here, is the fact that there is the option of the losing registrar to confirm with the registrant that the the transfer request is a legitimate request. Now, obviously, it's not required, and it doesn't hold up the transfer if the registrant doesn't respond. But, you know, perhaps if it was more consistently used, it may help to prevent, you know, some of the fraudulent transfers that occur. If, you know, if the name is, you know, a very high-value name, it seems that the registrant would be, I guess, kind of watching for that type of confirmation to come through, perhaps. So this may be another option that's out there to try to help circumvent it while still, you know, kind of having that two-key approach that was just mentioned.
Matt?
Thanks, Michele. Yeah,
congratulations on the new arrival, by the way, Matt. This is the first time I've had you on a call.
Thank you. Appreciate it. I'm a little tired, but I've been paying attention so far. That's a good point as well. But I just wanted to kind of pick up on what James said and agree essentially that I think actually looking at defining those roles a little better and making it clearer is probably a good step. But I still agree with Mikey that the intent of what we put together here I still support. You know, I still think that having one authoritative party that's responsible for authorizing the transfer, and in my mind it's the registrant over the admin, is the way to go. Now, whether or not we need to look at the actual wording and tweak that a little bit, you know, it's something that we can work on. But I think James is probably right that, you know, spending some time identifying what the role of the registrant is versus what the role of the admin is and who's authorized and can do what is probably a good exercise.
Okay, thank you. Okay, let's move on to the next comment there. This is from the registries, saying that requiring thick QAs would have as a potential side effect that registrant contact information is more readily available for individuals with nefarious intent to obtain access to the information as well. James, go ahead.
Hi, James speaking, and I don't mean to pick on the registries here, but are they then suggesting by this comment or implying that those registries that are SIC are a security risk and should consider becoming SIN?
Barbara, do you want to jump on that one, or do you want to take one for the team?
Well, I guess I'll have to take one for the team, but I don't think that that's the case. I think that In some cases, I know that the registries, obviously, that VeriSign operates, two of them are thin, one of them is thick, but due to, you know, various privacy laws and such, we have varying levels of who is access available for .name, for instance. So, you know, we have a summary level, and then we have an enhanced, I believe, and then a detailed view that's available with an additional contract so that the information isn't out there and, you know, fully available as far as registrant details are concerned. So I think that there may be some other registry operators that have to do a polling of the other registries to confirm this. But I think that there are some others that have, you know, perhaps some additional information that's not as readily available, even though they do have thick whois. So I'm not certain that all of the registries actually publish the registrant details, which I think is one of the main items that was under discussion as being resolved by having a thick whois.
Okay, thank you. I put myself in the queue. I think this comment suggests is going more to display rather than collection, so I think it's possibly causing, I mean, thick whois does not necessarily mean that the registry will display all of the details. So, for example, .tel is thick. Yes, it'll display very little. .eu is thick, yet it displays very little. So I'm not entirely sure. And this thing about contact information for individuals being nefarious, I don't really understand where they're getting at. Surely it's the same in thin whois, but hey, who am I to consider? Moving on to the next one, unless somebody has anybody else got any other comments on 30? Mikey?
Yeah, this is Mikey. I just want to amplify what you said, Michele. I think that we do need to be careful to not confuse the operational characteristics of a ThickWhois, which has a lot of advantages, not just in this domain, but lots of other places too, with, like you said, Michele, what's actually displayed. I think that that's a false dichotomy, and we should be careful to point that out. Sorry, Barbara. But, you know, I really think that this is quite important, and want to make sure that we don't waver on this one.
Okay, thank you. Moving on to 31. If a confirmation of the transfer by... Oh, sorry, go ahead, Barbara. You're defending yourself.
If I could just add one thing. You know, I think that, you know, the nefarious activity that we were looking at here and, you know, the potential for that basically comes from the fact that if the registrant details are publicly available, it just provides potential hijackers with more information to be able to perhaps go in and compromise an email account, change the information of the registrant, and be able to hijack a name. So that's kind of where we were coming from that perspective. I don't know if that's verified or not.
Okay. I'm a little confused. I just did a Whois lookup on a .biz, and I could do the same on, well, on a lot of other TLDs. What is the difference that you are pointing at that I'm not seeing?
Well, I guess, and I'm sorry, this is Barbara again. It seems to me that the conversations that we had surrounding this was that most people, just as you were saying, Michele, wanted the ThickWhois and to have the information actually displayed so that the gaining registrar, for instance, would be able to do that confirmation with the registrant, who, of course, has the trumping authority, if you will, over the admin contact to authorize a transfer. So I guess for that information to be available to the, and maybe I misunderstood, but for it to be available to the losing registrar to be able to do that confirmation, it would almost have to be publicly available.
Okay. James and then Mikey?
Yeah, real quickly, if I'm understanding this, that this is the part I think that confuses me about this particular statement, number 30 by the registry stakeholder group, is that the information is available. It's required to be displayed by the registrars. So the thick versus thin debate really just determines where you go to get that publicly information and publicly available information, but it is available. Now, if a registrar is not compliant and does not display the contact contact information that they need for to authorize transfer in a thin registry, then that's an issue for ICANN compliance. And it's almost sounding here like we're backwardly saying that's a security enhancement for them not to display that. And I guess we've circled around at this, and now we're coming at it backwards to where we're saying that we shouldn't have the information that registrars are required to display. So I guess I'm confused.
And I would confirm that I'm confused as well, James. Mikey?
This is Mikey. Just to add to the confusion, I think that there is a distinction between information being available, say, registrar to registry or vice versa, and information being publicly displayed that we might, you know, sort of like the last one, we might explore a little bit more. It might be that, one of the advantages that ThickWhois is that a lot more information is collected and available system to system, registrar to registry, et cetera, et cetera. And to a certain extent, there's a bit more flexibility on which of those data elements actually get publicly displayed, and then another advantage would be that would be a choice that's made once for a top-level domain instead of registrar by registrar. So there might be room in the conversation to dive a little bit more deeply into the distinction between sort of the operational advantages of a thick registry and which pieces of the information are publicly displayed, but I'm not sure that's in our scope.
Okay, thank you, Mikey. Michael, and then I think we'll move on, but I think this particular comment, I'm going to kick it back to the registries.
Well, I was only going to... Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was only going to say that I think that for the thin registries, the registrar contact information is not required, although many registrars may display that information. I think it's only the admin contact information that's required, and that sort of is the source of the cause for this whole discussion, I think.
Excuse me, I'm typing rapidly here, trying to do Whois lookups. Just looking at, for example, GoDaddy.com's Whois. Sorry, James. The registrant is listed, but there's no registrant email address, whereas there is an admin contact email address. However, Paul, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks, Michaelis. Paul, that's the point I've been trying to make on the list. In a thin model, the registrant email is not a required field for publication. Admin contact is. In the thick model, it's more likely going to appear. So in theory, at least, a thick model could be less secure in that a hacker can see what the email address is, and if it's a Hotmail or Yahoo or something like that, it's that much easier to take over. And as the registrant, appearing as a registrant, having taken over that email, it makes the hijacking process that much easier. So just following what Michael Collins just said, that's accurate. That in thin, ultimately you have some sense of security in that the registrant email is not necessarily publicly available. It's not required.
Okay, but just to counter that, Paul, and it's Michele, if their Whois service is either A, not working, or B, dysfunctional, unreliable, or has stupidly low rate limits, you won't be able to do anything with the domain, such as conduct a legitimate transfer.
Agreed, Michele. But for the purpose of the group, I think what the registry comment was getting at was not for the off case of somebody with dysfunctional Whois service, but rather for the overall process. And again, the thin models do not require publication of the registrant email.
Okay. Mikey, then Barbara, then Matt.
I was just going to amplify what I said before, which is the difference between collecting information and publishing it. It seems to me that one of the things that we could explore is requiring that the email address be collected and maintained, but at the same time allow either discretion or actually prohibiting the publication of it for that very security reason. So I think splitting the gathering and maintaining of the information from the publication of it might be a good avenue for discussion.
Okay. Barbara, and then Matt?
The only point that I wanted to make is in a thin registry, the registries don't even have within the database any of the registrant or admin contact, billing, technical details at all to even have an option to make it available publicly or otherwise.
Okay.
So I guess it being required, there really couldn't be a requirement because it doesn't exist in the thin registries database.
Matt?
Not to rain on everyone's parade, but is this almost a moot point? I mean, the requirements for new GTLDs going forward is thick Whois. So essentially we're left with Common Net with being the only TLDs that have thin Whois. So it seems to me like whatever policy that we come up with should be for the majority of the TLDs, which is going to be thick who is. Sorry.
Maz, I'd counter that, and this is Michele. I'd counter that by simply pointing you at the statistics. Whether, if you look at the number of TLDs using thick versus number of TLDs using thin, then thick wins. If you look at the number of actual domain names registered, then I think thin wins.
Agreed, absolutely. But again, I think it's at least a point worth discussing.
Oh, I don't disagree. I'm just arguing with you for the sake of it.
Yeah, no, I know the numbers don't add up, but you know, maybe that's not the case. Barbara, cover your ears in 5 years. I don't know.
Hey, listen, we just like picking on you when you're weak, Matt.
Oh yeah, well, hey.
There's some interesting discussion, which I will try to capture, on the chat about moving away from using email addresses to using usernames. And a few people have pointed out that there would be a lot of problems with that as well. Barry, you're saying a lot there in the chat. Would you like to say something on the call for the record?
Yeah, this is Barry. It's not that important. I'm just kind of batting around ideas. But, you know, in listening to all this dialogue about whether the email address should be published or not, and if it's very easy for someone to gain access to one's account using an email address if it were published like that, then if all registrar accounts were a separate, unique username and not an email address, that, to me, seems to me that minimizes that potential threat, but I'm not a technical expert in registrar operations, so I'm not sure how solid that is, but just pointing that out. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Putting myself in very quickly before I let Matt go, just in relation to Barry's comments about usernames, if any of you have registered a .tel domain, you would have got a username and a password for the Tel hosting system, and depending on how it's hooked up, you could end up with a unique username and password per domain, or you could have ended up with them all tied back to your email address, which is really apropos to nothing, I suppose. Matt, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to comment on the point about publishing usernames. Personally, that makes me a little nervous and uncomfortable. I mean, you know, part of the fact that a username is hidden is that someone can't call up and, you know, they can call us up and say, yeah, I'm calling from Google. Well, they don't have any idea what Google's username is. To publish that just gives someone a little bit more access and information than I think is appropriate.
Okay. Okay. I think this is interesting. I think we better move on a little bit. Actually, we're coming to... Let's try dealing with 31. If a confirmation of the transfer by using the FOA would be implemented consistently among losing registrars, it would help to reduce the number of instances when a transfer dispute arises. I think we've discussed that already on this call, haven't we? Now, 32... from the registries again. Registrars should implement a consistent policy regarding the proof required to undo a domain name transfer. Any reactions? Bob?
Is that not related to the ETRP discussion?
Beg your pardon?
Is that not related more to the ETRP?
No. This was under Quest Charter Question B.
Okay. All right. No, I thought based on the question that it was related to the question that the point that many people have been making around ETRP and, you know, to Mikey's point, the teeth that would have to be in that rule. I think otherwise, I think it's sort of motherhood and apple pie, I guess, in and of itself. You know, of course, consistent policy is a good thing. You know, I think the proof would be in the pudding in terms of working that through and developing it. Do we, as a group, feel as if there is inconsistency today, and that this would need to there would need to be more done to implement a consistent approach as opposed to the way it's done now?
Barbara, would you like to say anything on this?
Yeah, I'm hoping that I can maybe clarify this. I believe that this was in response to the fact that in the transfer disputes that come up oftentimes do relate to the fact that the registrant comes back and says, you know, I didn't authorize the transfer. The admin contacted actually sent it in, obviously. And some registrars, what we see here at the registry when we're handling transfer disputes is that some registrars will actually provide, you know, perhaps an affidavit from the registrant indicating that they, you know, were not aware of the transfer, that they didn't authorize the transfer and what have you. So I think what we were just trying to get to here is that it would be really helpful even for those that I think don't actually make it to the registry level, for registrars to perhaps have a consistent method for what they're asking for if in the case where a registrant is claiming that they didn't authorize the transfer and wants to play their trump card, you know, what the registrars are asking for in order to, in essence, authenticate the registrant and what authorization, if you will, they would accept in order to undo the transfer, send it back to the other registrar. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. Any other thoughts on that? No? Mikey?
I think I just want to voice my support for this idea. I think it's a good one. I think we ought to take a look at it.
Okay. Any other comments, thoughts? No? Okay.
Sorry, Chris here.
Oh, sorry, Chris. Go ahead.
All right. Yeah, just rereading, actually going back to the original SSAC report and on their page 8, where the actual incidents of hijacking have been, you know, explained. And it, you know, it really does come back to gaining control of the registrar account, the username and the password, obviously. And then the password, and there's one using an SQL injection attack, whatever that is, to regenerate a password. So if the username is the email address, that's definitely a weakness point that we should be recommending an independent username, I think.
Okay. Sorry, I see another hand there. It's Matt, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to comment on that last point that Chris made and just, I guess, caution us about kind of widening the scope of what we're addressing here. And it feels like we're starting to talk about things that are outside of inter-registrar transfer and more overall security and, you know, things like registrar account usernames and things like that. And while I have views on that stuff, I think it's outside the purview of what we're charged with doing here.
Matt, this is Michele, I would agree. And I also see that James would agree. Chris, I think it's a very valid question. I think it's one that I for one, would be more than happy to discuss with you. But I don't think that that IRTP is really the best place to get into that.
Yes, okay. I mean, where I'm sort of coming from, obviously, is sort of stepping back and looking at where the hijacks have occurred at transfer and seeing how they've occurred, just to focus us a little bit back on that and, you know, preventative measures for that. Where a lot of the discussions, a lot of the thoughts and the public comments and all the rest of it is a sort of at a higher level, isn't it, of if.
No,
that's just where I'm going, yeah.
This is Michele. Which working group was it in? There was some discussion somewhere, and I can't honestly remember where, about minimum security levels. I think it's in the RAAE, potential changes to the RAA discussions that are currently ongoing. And I think in there, and I could be wrong, but it's a wonderful mush of ICANN working groups in my brain at the moment. There was some stuff from ESSAC and the law enforcement to mandate minimum levels of security, with respect to registrars. And this is something I think has been bounced around a bit, and I think one of the areas where there could be some level of agreement would be to mandate PCI compliance to be a level, since most registrars would be processing credit card payments and therefore would have to be PCI compliant anyway. But as far as I know at present, this is really just something that's being talked about as opposed to anything beyond that. Right, it's almost 4 o'clock in my time zone, which is the only one I care about, so it's the end of the hour. I presume we'll just go ahead with our meeting next week, and we will continue with the looking at these comments. If anybody has any other queries or questions or wants to continue any discussions on anything, please do use the mailing list. Any other matters anybody wants to raise at this time?
Okay, this is Marika. Just a note, I'll send out the chat to the mailing list as well, as I think there's quite some good discussion there and might stimulate some further debate around these issues.
Okay, perfect. So if nobody has any thoughts or queries or questions or whatever, I shall call this meeting to a close and speak to you all next week. Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Michaela. Good call today.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.